A concept which has been very prominent in the last couple of weeks for different reasons, in the last 2 weeks because of the role it played in the purpose of the Torah, and before that the role it played in the discussion of the problem of evil, is the concept of Bechira Chofshit. And so we're going to talk about Bechira Chofshit for a while. The concept of free will. There's an interesting situation today, which not many people pay attention to. Depending on which room you go into in a university, you wind up with totally different attitudes towards the freedom of human beings, towards free will. If you hang around the humanities, including, to a great extent, political science, but more important, real humanities, so today, more than any other period of time, we glory in the notion of human freedom. Has political ramifications. That's basically the reason why. But the importance of freedom in our social lives is much greater now than it was 500 years ago when most people weren't free nor aspired to it. In other areas of the humanities, in literature, and in, to some extent in philosophy and social philosophy, so the greatest value is in the world is human freedom. This has its roots in philosophy. It has its roots in 19th century Romanticism and German Neo-Romanticism. But it's very, very important. We talk about values, etc. So the most important value that one can, I think to an exaggerated extent, but that one can possibly be committed to is other people's freedom, or your own freedom and other people's freedom. That's what distinguishes man from the beasts. On the other hand, if you hang around one, the sciences, two, a kind of, I guess today it's in the sciences, but a kind of pseudoscience called psychology, or in any field where people are influenced by the sciences, so you'll including parts of philosophy, you get the impression that we've come a long way and we've now proven conclusively there's no such thing as human freedom, and in fact the concept of freedom is a self-contradictory concept. That it doesn't happen to exist, but it makes no sense. Somehow these two trains of thought in modern society exist together. Every now and then they come to a clash. I read an article a week ago written by somebody who was trained as a biologist, but now writes books. And she all of a sudden she realized that she spent all those years studying and she doesn't believe any of that anymore. And not that the facts are wrong, but her whole attitude towards human beings had somehow changed, and she wondered what the connection was between. She thought that most of the students in class, in fact, were able to do what they were taught, but didn't actually believe it. The concept of human freedom, if you go back 1,000 years or 2,000 years, you go look in the Torah. How often is it stressed? How often is it based? When is it ever mentioned, except by Diuk in the Parsha about Avadim? It's the only time you'll ever find the way Chazal understood. But at the beginning of Parshat Mishpatim, it says something about human freedom. While talking about why there is no such thing, while talking about why there is such thing called as slavery, surely wasn't a well-known concept in the consciousness of Jews, of Mefarshim, of Chazal. You won't find them talking about freedom, chirut, or chofesh, particularly often, which is a reflection of the fact that nobody in the world talked about freedom, except in a very, very special, very, very theoretical manner. Socially, freedom is a product of the modern world as a value, something which one should value more than other things. It's surely a product of the modern world. If you went, let's say, when people understood it, you went back 200 years ago and you spoke about freedom, so that's what you're talking about. But if it came to a clash between freedom and social order, so everybody would have chosen social order. Freedom is very nice, but having a well-ordered society where people aren't allowed to do what they want and therefore cause other people discomfort is obviously much more important. It's only very, very recently that you have people seriously arguing that you have to pay a price for freedom, and if everything falls apart and people run around, as long as they don't hurt each other, so freedom is the ultimate human value. And nonetheless, as the Rambam points out, it's implicit in the Torah that human beings have freedom of choice, or else the entire Torah makes no sense. This is the Rambam's point in Hilchos Tshuva, Perikei, Perik Vav. The Rambam says that if there's no Bechira, then mitzvot make no sense. Why should God command if you're in some way programmed to do either one or the other. And two, what's even more important is that Sechav Onesh makes no sense. Because Sechav Onesh implies that you're deserving of the Sechav Onesh, you're only deserving of it if free will is involved in your choice. In other words, what the Rambam is really saying is that moral choice has to be free choice. There's no moral value, there's no ethical value in a choice that someone makes, or an act that someone does on the basis of his choice, if the choice did not involve what we call freedom. And so that's, you measure that by Sechav Onesh. In other words, if there's no moral value, then why is it Sechav Onesh? If for some reason there wasn't Sechav Onesh, it wouldn't really change the point, but that's the proof. In other words, if God is rewarding those who chose one way and punishing those who chose another way, then the reward is not for the act, but for the moral value, the choice that was involved, which has to be therefore a free choice. So the Rambam says, why would the God even command things, since people will do what they're programmed to do one way or the other, and therefore the commands in the Torah don't make any sense either. The Rambam goes so far as to say, there in Hilchos Teshuva, that nobody in Judaism has ever questioned that point. That's an exaggeration, obviously. There's nothing in Judaism that someone hasn't questioned, because Judaism belongs to the Jews, so it's not shaykh that somebody would have questioned everything. But nonetheless, what Rambam was really saying was that there's right Judaism and wrong Judaism, but then there's also obvious Judaism. And just Rambam could not conceive how anybody could have a theory of Torah which wouldn't involve a basic understanding that people have free choice. How valuable? To what extent is it a value? That probably is a more open question in the Middle Ages. There's an interesting Ramban. Interesting and difficult. The Ramban says in Parshat Breshit and repeats it in Parshat Ki Tavo. In other words, it's practically the sandwich of the Torah. It's one of the first Rambans, not the first, but one of the first Rambans in the Torah and one of the last. The Ramban claims that in Gan Eden, Adam HaRishon did not have Bechirah Chofshit. And he claims that B'mot HaMashiach, we will climb back to that better state. He explicitly says it was a better state. That the hope of Bechirah Chofshit, Umar Hashem et Levavecha, means that God will remove Bechirah Chofshit and will go back to having no Bechirah Chofshit. And no Bechirah Chofshit, for the Ramban, explain how he could possibly even say that, it means people will do the good because they're good. They will have good natures. Adam HaRishon was created, B'tzelem Elokim, he was created good. And therefore, he did the good, it was natural. White things drip white. Heavy things are heavy. Good things do good. That's what that was his nature. The Achilat Eitz Hadat, Ramban claims, introduced psychologically he means that a certain detachment between what we know and what we instinctively feel. And therefore, the man's connection to good was no longer natural, and if he had to choose. And then he got the ability to have free choice. Before that, and eventually after that, when the world gets repaired, so we want to have Bechirah Chofshit. The Abavanel, on that Ramban, faints. He doesn't usually have such strong reactions. The Abavanel says, how can anybody say that? The greatness of human beings is their freedom. What Ramban is saying, says the Abavanel, is that man was created imperfect. He was created no good. Not having freedom is a lack. Being good without freedom is less than being free. And we'll see what happens. And if it's inconceivable, says the Abavanel, that should be the pshat in the story of Eitz Hadat, or the pshat in Umar Hashem Levavecha, and the tshuva of Yemot HaMashiach. How to explain the Ramban is a good question. I'm not going to do that now. I don't actually know 100%. I have different thoughts about Ramban. Ramban is profoundly disturbing to me. I like Ramban a lot, and this is really inconceivable what he writes there. I don't think he meant it exactly the way it sounds, but he does say it. In other words, Ramban really is raising an important moral question. The Ramban's question is, and this is a question which does repeat itself, is in order to have freedom in the sense that most people understand it, that you can equally choose A or B, the Ramban is saying that then A and B have to be basically indistinguishable. They have to be the same. We don't actually have free choice, say, to choose between taking poison or eating food. Because today we would say, psychologically, we're hardwired to self-preservation. And Maman wouldn't say it psychologically in terms of brain science, but he would say, you know, like, yeah, you're hardwired in the sense that this is the right choice and this is the wrong choice. And therefore, to the extent that you're not totally insane, then of course you're going to choose to eat the good food and not to commit suicide. Unless you have some other reason which we're not discussing. And therefore, in morality as well, the man is saying that the way a person can have perfect choice in choosing between good and evil would be if he was in no way committed one way or the other. You know, as if it were just if both choices were exactly equal to him, but they're never equal. If you have the character, and I once pointed out when I quoted the Ramban on the Akedah, Ramban believes in what he calls Lev Tov. People have character. Goodness is part of your character, or not. But it defines your character. Some people have a predilection to anger. Some people, in other words, they have a loose wire in their anger center of their brains. And some people have a predilection, or they've developed a predilection, or they've created a predilection for goodness. They're sympathetic people. They're merciful people. That's a quality of human being. Well, to the same extent that if you're irascible, you get angry very easily. If you're merciful, you cry very easily. And therefore, you do mitzvot v'hetein. So therefore, the Ramban is saying that if a person would really have only a good character, of course he would do good. And that's what it should be. That's the way God made you. And that's what we aspire to become in the future if everything goes well. So if there's something called freedom of choice now that has real meaning, it must be because you're not really a good person. You think about it. You're choosing to be either A or B. But as far as your actual character, it must be in some sense neutral, or almost neutral, or at least partially neutral, so that you're able to choose. That, without agreeing with the Rabban's conclusion, is a very, very difficult question, the questions of freedom constantly revolve around it. And of course it's highly magnified by the modern understanding, not so modern, by the Greek understanding, and therefore the modern understanding of causation. The way you act, the way anything takes place, is based on the causes beforehand. There's nothing that we know of, nor could it be even conceivable anymore. So science is based on the idea that every effect has a cause. Epicurus, a Greek philosopher who lent his name to a most common philosophy today, that known as Epicursot, has many forms. But Epicurus basically only said one thing. And Epicurus was an atomist. He thought that everything was made out of little atoms, not 98. How many atoms are there today? There were 98 when I was a kid. 112? Not 112 different kinds of atoms, but just atoms. Everything was made of little particles of matter. And then he claimed the following. He said the atoms are moving through the universe in straight lines. And every now and then, one of them swerves to the left or to the right. And why does that take place? Kacha. That was Epicurus' Chiddush. And apparently that's why he was an Epicurus. I'm not sure that Chazal called him Epicurus for that reason, but in Greek society he was considered to be a heretic because he didn't believe in law, he didn't believe in regularity, he thought things can just be happen just stam. The Rambam, in his discussion of Hashkacha, which I mentioned 2 weeks ago, so he says there are five theories of Hashkacha. The first one is no Hashkacha, and that's the theory of Epicurus. The second one is yesh Hashkacha, that's Aristotle. We don't think of Aristotle as being a great person who believes in Hashkacha, but for the Rambam, he does believe in Hashkacha. Hashkacha klalit, lo Hashkacha pratit. Why? Because the Rambam says, because Aristotle says that everything takes place for a reason. There's a cause for everything. That's Hashkacha. It doesn't make a difference who's being Mashkech, but there is Hashkacha. You can't just say it's absurd. But Epicurus was really a kofer, apparently in Greek terms, way before he was a kofer in Jewish terms. I can't believe the Chazal called him a kofer because of this, but they simply inherited the word. Epicurus was a kofer because he said things can just happen. Now that is freedom. Epicurus said that's the basis of freedom. Why did it take place? The atoms are free. The atoms are free, not that they have consciousness, but they're free to swerve left or right. Nothing forces them to continue moving in a straight line. But that, of course, to us is a meaningless kind of freedom. It doesn't do anything. It's not a choice between good or evil. It's not a choice to obey or not to obey God. We wouldn't call it a choice. It's simply a joke. It's a distortion. Things don't take place the way you expect them because no rule is involved. So we're looking for a freedom that isn't Epicurean freedom, but it's the freedom to make a moral choice. The freedom to make a moral choice is not an even choice. It's the choice between what's correct, what's right, and what's wrong. What kind of a choice is that for a moral individual? A moral individual is pre-programmed, both by his nature and by his choice, by his pre-choices and by everything he is, to choose one over the other. That apparently is what's bothering the Ramban. And the Ramban really claims that I aspire to get beyond it. The similar problem is involved historically. It's not exactly the same problem. It's not a question of freedom, but a question of morality. But it comes into the same question in Kant's analysis of morality. It's well known. Kant said that a moral action is an action you do because of the moral imperative, not because you like it. In other words, he's very much makbid on lishma. You have to, the moral choice is one in which you do it because something outside you is telling you to do it. Which frankly was what we talked about. That was how we proved. That's how Kant proves the existence of God. The moral proof of the existence of God, which I mentioned 3 months ago, is from Kant. Kant made it up. Since we hear this voice, since something outside us tells us to do something, that proves that there is a God. And so he's talking, but it proves that something exists supernaturally, something is above nature, which is mechayev us, tells us what to do. So then Kant asked the following question, but suppose you really like being a good person. When you give tzedakah, you get a good feeling. So Kant says that distracts, it diminishes the moral value in what you're doing. Of course, Kant was aware of the fact that it hardly seems like a bad thing. In other words, it seems like a good thing that a person is good and sweet and likes being good. Why is that a bad thing? So Milet Breira, he had to make up a new category. And he said the person who is such a wonderful tzaddik that he just naturally helps people. He just likes helping people and he feels sorry for people and he just does it. There's no real conflict about it. This is what he wants to do. So he's not an ethical individual. He's a holy individual. He just had to make up another term so as not to be negative about it. He doesn't want to say he's immoral, but what he's doing is no longer moral because he's doing it because that's his nature. And then it's no different than people who sink when they put in water because it's their nature to sink. It's not a moral act with these people, or people who sing because they like singing. So you like giving tzedakah. But it's just, you're just reflecting your particular personality. He pointed out quite correctly that none of us starts that way. You start as someone who is more or less neutral to these things, and the only way you become that is because of what we discussed in Efkasei Kreskas. If you do give tzedakah often enough, you, achrei ha-masim holech alev, you have changed your internal character. So it's fact that it's an accomplishment. Morality leads to holiness. But it leads to holiness by, according to Kant, by decreasing the amount of morality involved. That's a very difficult conclusion. To say that tzaddikim are not moral because they're tzaddikim, that only beinonim, basically, only people who have a... When you wake them up in the middle of the night, you ask them, what do you think? They have no predilection one way or the other. Only when they listen to the voice, they listen to the conscience, then they do things, which might be a lot of people in the room, but... And only they are moral, and people who are real tzaddikim are not moral anymore. Somehow doesn't settle well in our Jewish hearts. So that's one question. What do we actually mean by freedom? Philosophically today, in Anglo-American philosophy at least, freedom is considered to be a dead end. There's no such thing. The basic mode of thought is that everything has causes and it's completely caused by the causes. The effect is the sum of the causes. There's nothing left over. There's nothing missing. And if you describe something's causes, you describe the effect. And therefore, we naturally assume if somebody does something, there's going to be a reason for it. And the reason will be described as it'll be described. In the sciences, that's why psychology is a changing movement. Psychology, for Aristotle, to go back 3,000 years ago, was not a science. It was a piece of philosophy. It was describing how souls relate to the outside world. Over the history of psychology, is making psychology part of science. And so Freud was a form of scientific psychology. But today, real scientists, of course, think that Freud is off the wall. Science consists of physics, and therefore the gradual development of psychology is to psychiatry, and psychiatry to brain science, and brain science to chemistry, and chemistry to is a form of physics. So we can more or less, if we take apart the brain of a human being, we will understand his, what you call psychology, basically understand what he thinks is his freedom. But freedom itself is an illusion. This is what most scientific psychologists think. Freedom is an illusion created by you not aware of what your brain is doing. There was an experiment conducted 2 or 3 years ago, which was supposedly to prove that freedom doesn't exist. Logically, it doesn't do it, but people who proposed it thought it did. They discovered the following. On the basis of doing MRIs, of reading people's brains, which of course you can't read people's brains, you can only read that something lit up. That's the whole fallacy in MRI research. But nonetheless, they found that when people make choices, you ask them to choose, or something simple, you ask them to choose between a lemon and an orange. I don't think they do MRI exams on people who are choosing whether or not to kill somebody or not. It's hard to get the machine on their heads while they're facing the actual choice. Maybe you could do it with a movie, but it wouldn't be the same thing. No, they actually give them lemons and oranges. Okay, they have to choose between eating a lemon or eating an apple. And so the person makes a decision. What they discovered is that the part in the brain, which the scientists believe is where you make the choice, lights up a second and a half before you actually are conscious of the fact that you've made the choice. Which was meant to show that our experiential experience, our phenomenological experience of choice, has already been, is obviously an illusion, because the choice has already been made earlier, because the brain is already lit up. Apparently you've already made the choice, you just weren't aware of it. So what the thing that you're experiencing, namely, oh, I'm going to take that side, that's caused by something which you're totally unaware of. We don't actually see our own brains. We don't experience our own brains. We experience something else. So our brains have already made up our mind. The brain, of course, is a bundle of nerves. So that's based on something else. And that proves that choice doesn't actually exist. It's a self delusion. Okay? Since today, brain research has basically proven that everything you do is an illusion. I don't think you have to take brain research all that seriously. My daughter happens to get paid a salary to be a brain scientist, but, you know, that's okay. Money's money. Basically, it's a pot of crack. It's only useful if the person has a tumor, when it's very important to know why he can't make decisions, because, yeah, you do need a brain to make a decision, but the rest of it is all based on self-serving surmise. But that's not the point. The point is that this is definitely the kibun of science. It's based on a very simple point, which Aristotle did say. Every effect has a cause. And that's, if you don't think every effect has a cause, you can't be a scientist in any sense whatsoever. If all of a sudden the lights go off in this room, we talked about this 3 months ago, if the lights go off in this room, everybody in the room is going to say, who turned off the lights? And if I say, no, nobody turned off the lights, they just went out. You say, oh, you mean that the filament broke? No, the lights just went out. Nothing happened. It just happened. There's no cause. So nobody in the room is willing to accept that, because I'm not even saying it's a nace. I'm not saying that God turned off the lights. I'm saying the lights turned off the lights. That's not an acceptable answer for any of you. And therefore, when you say that, okay, that's true about light bulbs, but it's not true about why I chose to come to this chug today, exceptions are always possible, but it's no longer in the moda. You can't. It's very difficult to maintain that way of thought, to say, okay, everything is, it stops here. Of course, Chazal said the very same sentence. They said it about God, not about physical causes, but they said, "Hakol bidei shemayim, kutz miyirat shemayim." They're saying that, yes, the buck stops here. There are certain areas in our experience to which the normal set of natural laws does not apply. But obviously, scientificism, the supremacy of science in the modern world, does not tend to accept there are certain areas where they shouldn't be messing around. There are two different, philosophically speaking, there are two different problems involved in, or theologically speaking, there are two different problems involved in freedom. So I'm going to talk about the first one today, even though it's not interesting. The second one we'll talk about the next time, 2 weeks. But the first one is famous. I don't think it's interesting, but obviously in the Middle Ages they thought it was interesting because they talked about it endlessly. The first one is the problem of Yedi'ah and Bechira. Well, the problems I just described till now have nothing to do with God. They have to do with the world, but they can be translated into God. There are two things we say about God which interfere with human freedom. One is Yecholet v'Bechira. If God is responsible for everything and nothing can exist outside of His will, then where's the room for my will? We have spoken in the past of how the definition of existing is God's will. That's the real meaning of B'yai Yesh Me'ayin. Not that God happened to have created a world once, but that creation, existence, means what God wants. But if that's true, then if I will something, it's suddenly because God willed it as well. Nothing can exist outside of God's will. That's one problem. That's the theological reflection of the philosophic problem I tried to describe till now. The other problem is Yidiyahu b'chira. It happens to be that Judaism says that God has foreknowledge. You know, Yidiyah of everything includes knowledge of the future. And that, as the Rambam is aware, is not true that all Jews held, but all Jews the Rambam respected held. The Rambam thinks it's davar pashut, that Judaism believes in that God knows the future, psukim, which more or less say it, and if God knows everything, then logically the Rambam thought he has to know the future. But if God knows the future, where does that leave me room to have free will? God knows that in exactly 60 seconds I'm going to raise my right arm. And therefore, there's no possibility for my not raising my right arm in another 45 seconds. And it's already been, if it's been foreknown, then it's foreordained. That was the question the Rambam asked. Rambam gives a very interesting answer to that question. The Rambam's answer to the question is, I don't know. An answer which, no, he said, quote, I don't know, not that I don't know. The Rambam said, I don't know. And he gloried in that answer, an answer which caused the Rabbi to say, if you don't know the answer, you shouldn't have asked the question. But the Rambam likes that answer because he says that, was I on time? I wasn't checking my watch. I wasn't checking my watch because I didn't have to check my watch. It wasn't a free action. The Rambam uses this point to say that we shouldn't, that we don't understand the meaning of God's knowledge. That as if it was human knowledge, if a human being knew the future, then the future would be foreordained. But God's knowledge works in a different manner, and therefore, somehow or other, doesn't foreordain the future. But I can't explain to you how. It's an interesting answer. You can't possibly understand the answer. The Rambam doesn't want you to understand the answer. He wants to show you that you don't understand a lot of other things either. He's trying to show you to be more, you should be more modest. But it's clear that the Rambam says that that's the correct thing. The correct answer, which Rambam rejected for reasons that I'll try to explain very quickly, but not important. The correct answer is given by Rav Sajigon. Rambam knew the answer because he read it in Rav Sajigon. The correct answer is given by Rav Sajigon. And I'll explain very, very quickly how it works, because people somehow, I don't know why, still get confused by this. If I find it right. Not allowed to do that. Nobody knows. How much do I owe you? What's it going to take? Can I get you for 2 shekels a piece? You get it to lock and never come down again?
It wasn't your fault.
Why isn't this white? And the logical argument of Yidiyahu b'chira another inch, that's it. Why would they make things you can't get off? There we go. The logical argument is as follows. It looks like a very simple argument. This is the way logicians write arguments. You write a series of propositions. So, statement one is God knows. Let's pick something. God knows that A will take place. Okay. Okay. Statement two. That's statement of fact. God knows a lot of things. Bonnie knows that as well. It follows from that A will take place. Since God knows everything, then everything that God knows is true. Sounds right. Actually, we should do it this way. We should do first make a theological statement that God knows everything. That's the statement of that's the logical assumption. This is the statement of fact. And it follows from A and 1, it follows that 2. A will take place. Which it follows that not A cannot take place. And therefore, there's no freedom of choice. Very, very simple, very, very simple argument. What's the answer? Well, Sajidon's answer, he didn't put it exactly in these terms, but Sajidon said, this is all true. But the question is, how does God know that A will take place? The way this is written, it appears that one is the cause of two. Since God knows A will take place, therefore A will take place. But of course, that's not the fact. Not in terms of the order of the propositions, but in the order of causation. What's the relation between one and two? Sajjivan says two is the cause of one. Since A will take place, therefore God knows that A will take place. And therefore, there's no kasher at all. You have freedom of choice. Freedom of choice is found here in this sentence. Freedom. And if you choose to do A, then God knows and always knew you would do A. If you choose to do B, God knows and always knew that you would choose B. To give an example, let's start it from the present, which won't be that impressive, but nonetheless. Let's say you have freedom of choice. Now, I'm not God. I don't know the future. You have freedom of choice. Now you choose to raise your right arm. I know you chose to raise your right arm. I have very good vision. Not perfect. Not God. But I have very good vision. Offhand, 99% of the time, if I see something, and I think it took place, then it took place. If you raise your right hand, I know you raised your right hand. If you raise your left hand, I know you raised your left hand. So, bo bizman, gito v'yado bayin ke'echad. Those of us who are learning Gittin. So, I know that you raised your right hand at the same time that you raised your right hand. What's the temporal connection between them? They're contemporaneous. They both took place at the same time. What's the logical connection? First, you raise your right hand, and then I know you chose your right hand. It happens to be like Gita Vyada Vayagaka, because I see really fast. Truth is, it takes me 1 millionth of a second, because it takes time for the light to get here. But even if I knew it instantly, the logical connection is first, not first in time, but first in cause. First, you have to raise your hand, and then I know. If you don't understand that argument, then you're missing quite a few sugyas in Gittin that I assume you've already learned. Everybody in the room has already learned Chatzer, no? Chav Kimmel? Chav Bet? Okay, so if you don't understand how something can be contemporaneous and nonetheless logically in order, then you just missed out on a very important subject. Okay? So now, God knows things in the future. Doesn't make a difference. I can know things in the future also. Sometimes. If I squint, you know, like I know, for instance, it's going to rain tonight. I don't know it perfectly, but I do know it's going to rain tonight. Now, the fact that I know it's going to rain tonight, but what's the order here? No, it's not that I know it's going to rain and therefore it's going to rain. My knowledge doesn't cause the rain. What's the order? Because it's going to rain tonight, and because I have seen the simanim in the present, I can't see the future. I figured out, I've seen certain things, therefore I know it's going to rain tonight. Now, God, for reasons, in a way which I cannot describe, can see into the future. The way that, you know, many people in the world think that people can see into the future also. Certain kinds of people, the kind with, you know, squinty eyes and voodoo. But, you know, many people believe that. You don't have to be a deep philosopher to believe that. God can see into the future. But to see the future means you see what's there. Which means that when someone sees the future, who's causing whom? It's not the seeing causes the act. The act in the future causes the seeing in the present. Now, that happens to go against a well-known Aristotelian rule, that the cause has to precede the effect. Okay, so that's your kasha. All right, so God defies that rule. The rule is not Kodesh Kadoshim. In the case of God, the future is the cause of God's knowledge in the presence. Not a little bit uncomfortable if you're Aristotelian, but not terrible. Truth, if you're Aristotelian, it's okay in any event, because according to Aristotle, at least according to the understanding of Aristotle, God is above time. God doesn't exist in time. So it's not true that the future is the cause of God's knowledge in the present. The future is the cause of God's knowledge, but God is not in the present. I don't understand that, but that's what all people in the Middle Ages think, and I believe, to the best of my knowledge, that's the only piece of Aristotelian theology which is still taught in third grade in yeshivas. I don't know why, but I'm sure they'd be very embarrassed to know they're teaching something which is purely Aristotelian. But Aristotle says that God is above time, because time is only can exist for things which are material. And for some reason, I'm sure you heard it as well, at some place in elementary school education, we're taught that God is above time, without anybody in the room knowing what that means, because it's basically a meaningless sentence. But somehow that has survived 500 years of anti-Aristotelian Jewish philosophy. So according to that, it's even simpler. It's not that a future event causes something in the presence of God. God doesn't have a presence. He doesn't have a future. He doesn't have a past. He's simply above it all. So something in the future, in our future, causes something in God. Or to put it another way, something which you probably learned, I learned it in second grade, but I went to a really good school. You probably learned it in fifth grade. There's this theory which they teach kids in fifth grade when they learn about Einstein's theory of relativity. Why not? Makes sense, fifth grade. So you told that Einstein said, which he didn't, Einstein said that time is the fourth dimension. He never said it, but it's okay. If he didn't say it, then who would believe it? So it's good to say it in Shmo. Einstein said that time is the fourth dimension. And then, the final thing, how does God know the future? God is a fourth dimensional creature, or fifth dimensional creature, or multi-dimensional creature. In other words, we can't see time because we're living in three dimensions. If you're living in four dimensions, you would see the future as another dimension. Anybody here read Flatlands? Anybody here hear Flatlands? Anybody American hear Flatlands? Okay, so in Flatlands there's this interesting demonstration of that fact. The Flatlands is about two-dimensional creatures. And if you have a piece of paper, and on the piece of paper there are squares and triangles, they're the people of the land. Now, if you take a pencil, not a pencil, better than a pencil, you take a funny pencil, a pen, and you pass it through the paper, so the people in Flatlands, the squares and circles and hectagons and thing, what will they see? They'll see a point, which grows and becomes bigger, and then gets smaller, and then becomes bigger, and then gets a bump here, bump there, and then eventually disappears. They will see something taking place in time. But I, who live in three dimensions, simply see a pen. A pen is a three-dimensional object passing through a two-dimensional plane. So what we consider to be time is four-dimensional things passing through our three-dimensional plane. But God can see four-dimensional things because he has at least four dimensions himself. That sounds a little cryptic. So let's say God has an infinite number of dimensions or something along those lines. That's what I was taught in second grade, between the second and third grade. I had a very good... I had a very good Ganenet, very good teacher for, not my English teacher, this was my Kumish teacher. Whatever, doesn't make any sense either. But the point is that seeing is gathering information. Knowing is obtaining information. If I know something, what's the relationship between me and what I know? I don't care if it's temporal or not temporal. If I know something in the future or in the past, I'm not talking about God now. If I know something in the present, about the present, about the past, or about the future, what's the relationship between the object of my knowledge and my knowledge? The answer is the object is the cause of the knowledge, not the other way around. Now, I have to tell you something. The Rambam knows that. And he says, that's something else that's different about God. By us, objects, facts are the cause of our knowledge. But by God, God's knowledge is the cause of the objects, which is why the Rambam does not accept Rav Sajigal's answer. Because Raman thinks that it's usher philosophically to say, that God is caused by anything else. God, by definition, is absolute. Absolute means it does not exist relative to anything else. Therefore, nothing can be a cause of God. God is the cause of everything, but nothing is the cause of God. So he can't give a Sajigal's answer. But that already is a Aristotelian blick of the Rambam. For us, I think it's sufficient to say that, yes, God is the cause of the world, but what takes place in the world is a cause of God's knowledge. An American philosopher, Charles Hartshorn, once said about the Aristotelian idea, the Middle Ages idea, that God is the cause of what is, and not what is the cause of God's knowledge. He said, "What if we said that about somebody else? If I look at the wall, so what I know about the wall is not caused by the facts. Whether the wall is white or black, I know it's white. That wouldn't be a compliment. That would be an insult. There are objects which have that kind of knowledge. For instance, this shtender, the Shtender, whatever it knows, is that kind of knowledge. It knows things about this room that don't take in, are not caused or affected by what takes place in the room. That's because it's a Shtender. But if you know something, let's say take two people. One of them, his knowledge is more or less unaffected by the world. The other one, he's extremely sensitive. If there's a slight change in temperature in this room, I immediately know it. So which one? But with most of you, if there'd be a 2-degree change of temperature in the room, you wouldn't notice it. So who of us has better knowledge of the temperature? I do. Sensitivity, in other words, being affected, being caused by the facts, makes better knowledge, not worse knowledge. But in the Middle Ages, it's true that Aristotelian philosophers thought that you can't say that about God, because God's not allowed to be caused. Therefore, God's knowledge is not affected by what takes place. In order not to make that ridiculous, they said that, what takes place is affected by God's knowledge. God knows the world, and therefore the world exists. And therefore, God, if you have free choice, but God, the reason why you have free choice is because God knows you have free choice, so God's knowledge precedes logically your free choice. Well, Sadiq goes to answer, it's not true. Sadiq wasn't Aristotelian, he didn't have these handcuffs. He said, no problem. God squints, looks into the future, sees what I will freely choose, and he already knows it yesterday. So it's true that if God knows that A will take place, A must take place. But that doesn't mean that B couldn't take place, because if B would take place, then God would know that B would take place. This sentence comes before this sentence, not temporally, but logically. First of all, I choose to raise my right hand, and then God knows that I will raise my right hand. That's the real answer to the question. Yes?
That seems to be working under the assumption that Hashem is not predicting what's going to happen or rather seeing what's going to happen.
Absolutely.
Then how does Hashem...
But that everybody agrees to. The reason why, from where does it come, the doctrine that God knows the future? It's not actually based on a couple of psukim. It's sure the Rav Sukkim would say it one way or another, but frankly the Ravag, the new Sukkim, didn't have any problem saying that God does not know the future, because the Sukkim you can always manage. The reason why philosophers in the Middle Ages say that God knows the future is because God knows everything, and the future is something. The future is also something, it's a fact. The Ravag, who says that God doesn't know the future, among other things, says that the future doesn't exist, and therefore it's not an object of knowledge. But if you think the future is true, which everybody in the room basically thinks, I assume, unless you've been studying Bertrand Russell, the statement that in a week's time I will choose to have steak on Monday, is that statement either true or false? What's the right answer? What?
We don't know.
I know you don't know, but I'm asking, is it true? I'm asking whether it's true. I'm asking you, is it either true or false? Everybody thinks the answer is yes. Well, if it's either true or false, then God knows that it's true or false, one or the other, but he knows the right answer. The Ravag's argument, it's a Middle Ages argument, which came back into a favor in the early 1900s, was that the statement is neither true nor false. Not yet. When it happens, it'll be true or it'll be false. But today, future statements simply don't exist. We can talk about them, they look like sentences, descriptive sentences, but they're not really descriptive. You cannot describe the future because it doesn't exist. That was Bertrand Russell's argument, and in fact it was Ravag's argument. But everybody else thinks that the future exists, in the future, but it exists, and therefore if God knows everything, therefore God knows it. But yes, he really knows it. The same way that he knows the present. How does he know the present? By looking. How does he know the past? By remembering. How does he know the future? By foretelling. But he's not predicting it, he's seeing it. Yes?
That poses another problem, because Hashem occasionally affects the world. He changes things.
Hey, he does that too.
But he needs to know the result of it, he needs to know what the result of his actions are going to be. But since he didn't take his actions yet, he can't see what the result of his actions would be.
You want to know what God has free will? That's what you want to know?
Well, actually, I thought that would be the problem, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. it's not a problem. If God has free will, he knows that also. What's the deal? God, he reads the map.
Wait, but
Hashem
knows what he's going to do?
What?
Hashem knows what he's going to do?
Why not? Is that a problem? Even I know what I'm going to do. Why can't God know what he's going to do? No, I know what I'm going to do.
I know, except
occasionally when I break my arm, God doesn't break his arm. What's the problem?
But I can always change my mind. Hashem, by that logic.
Yeah, but he knows that he's not going to change his mind. Just because he doesn't change his mind. God changes his mind. He doesn't change his mind. But even if he does change his mind, he knows he's going to change his mind. What's the big deal? If you read the future, you read the future. It's bothering you. I'll tell you what's bothering you. Because the truth is, there is a
certain amount of busyness involved in the thing. First of all, we have a problem with the concept of time. Anytime we talk about time, we begin to get queasy. It's very difficult. I said now, which sounds okay, but when you think about the Maisa, that I choose in the future, and therefore God knows it in the past, it is already. If you said about a person, you know, this person has the amazing ESP ability to know what I'm going to do tomorrow. So I look at him and say to him, "You know what I'm going to do tomorrow?" He says, "Yeah." And I say, "Okay, now tell me, because I'm going to do the opposite." So he's clever. He says, he lies. He says, "I know you're going to go left." Never go right. He says, "I knew that all the time." In other words, but if he knows the future, he knows the future. We have a problem with time. The other thing you have a problem with is you have a problem with freedom. That's the truth. The concept of free will is bothering you here because I introduced the free action as a cause of something, namely of God's knowledge. Now, obviously, free action could be a cause of something that takes place afterwards. If I choose my free will to scribble on the movie screen, then it has an effect. Right? Unfortunately. So, in this case, it has an effect on God's mind. Yes, God's mind, l'mafeya, knows what you're going to do. Logically, there's no problem here, but the more you think about it, the more, there's a phrase used by, what's his name, Norman Malcolm once said about something else, that it causes intellectual vertigo, intellectual dizziness. Not physically dizzy, but sure, intellectually dizzy. Anytime we start talking about time, it's like those movies that talk about what happens if you go back in time. Must be a million science fiction movies. Person makes a time machine, goes back in time, and then changes the conditions that create the ability for him to go back in time, and you can't get out of it. Therefore, they made up a whole new rule. It's a famous rule of science fiction that when you go back in time, you're not allowed to change anything. If you change anything, we're stuck. Our tongue begins to fall out. But you know, there are important physicists who think you can go back in time. I mean, the man can't talk or move, but Stephen Hawking still considered to be a better clever guy. He thinks it's physically possible to go back in time. He hasn't figured out how to do it yet. Without taking all your molecules apart and changing them into something else. Now, as to whether or not there's really a rule that says you're not allowed to change the past, I leave to movie makers. But it's very difficult to think about it. You know, I go back in time, and I eliminate the machine that I use to go back in time. So that leaves me in the past forever, right? Because, no, not really. It leaves me in the future forever. I don't know what it does. We get stuck. The build is very difficult to find. Time is very difficult to think about. It's much easier to think about space. Commonly, in modern physics, time and space are considered to be just two different lines on the graph. But space, we're able to hop. You know, I'm here and then I'm there. But time, we just have problems because it only works in one direction. And it goes at a constant rate. We just get stuck, we try to think about it.
The same logical problem that would occur if Hashem told me what I'm going to do tomorrow.
Ah, you're right, 100%, he shouldn't tell you. That's why God doesn't tell you so much.
But he could tell me if he wanted to.
If he told you, that would severely impact on your Bechira Chashas. Severely, but not impossibly.
But
severely, if God, who I know, if I know that God knows everything, and I also know that he doesn't fool around, if God tells me, tomorrow, you are going to do something to Bechira Chashit, psychologically, it will be very difficult for me to not
do.
Logically, you could do something else, and then it would turn out that, of course, God knew you could do something else. So either he lied to you.
But that means it's possible to tell me the truth. If you told me the truth, I would specifically do the opposite. So anyway, are we?
It's a psychological problem. It's not a logical problem.
But
and that is why God does not tell us the future all the time. If God would constantly tell us what we're going to do tomorrow, we wouldn't have any
Bechira
Chashit.
But I could do that if I wanted to.
You could definitely
do tomorrow. They do the opposite every time.
So I'm saying, in other words, there's a big difference. There's a big difference here between this statement, God knows that A will take place, and this statement, God told you that A will take place. There's a big difference between two statements, because this one, this, there's no contradiction whatsoever. God knows, and whatever you do is what He knows. If God tells you that A takes place, then it's ready to come out into the open, then it's impossible. Now, 1.5.5, God doesn't lie, which isn't exactly true. I mean, he lied about Avinu. But if you say God doesn't lie, then if God tells me that A will take place, and God doesn't lie, then A must take place, not because it takes place, but because he already said so. And then you couldn't do B. And there was, if God tells you what's going to happen, that severely, perhaps permanently, impairs your ability to do anything else. Which is why he doesn't usually do those things. That's why the future is meant to be is meant to be undisclosed. If you had two, if you had a VM that were too good, and you had an oracle, and you had an AFO, and you had the two room and two working around the clock, then psychologically Bechira Chash would be impossible, and logically it would be very, very difficult. You'd have to logically, when I did the opposite, it would be shown that the machine lied, or the machine made a mistake. The machine is guaranteed not to make a mistake and not to lie, and I'm guaranteed to have Bechira Chash, so they just exploded. It can't take place, which is why God doesn't tell you. He shouldn't tell you. He doesn't tell you. Just think what your life would be like if God told you that. Don't worry, you're gonna stay in yeshiva till Tisha B'Av. So if he means that when you try to leave, he'll break your leg, that's one thing. But if he's telling you, no, you're gonna choose to stay in yeshiva till Tisha B'Av, that truly has made the concept of free will nonsensical. That's the whole point of Avsajiga. That when people made the mistake of asking the kasha, they were thinking, well, God knows, and so at least someplace it's well known, so how can I do something else? The point is, God doesn't tell anybody. He doesn't tell anybody. It's between him. It's between him, himself, and himself. And therefore, that leaves the space for Bechira Chash to take place. That's true about a lot of things as well. That's true about a lot of things. If God would tell us, not just about Bechira Chash, if God would tell us even the present facts, it would severely impair our ability to have Bechira Chash. If God tells me that, if you choose to do the following, if you choose to walk out of this room now, you will fall into a ditch, that also will affect you, Bechira Chash. If we know everything about the world, if we know, for instance, that if you choose to do anything, you're going to go ahead of him, you also wouldn't have Bechira Chash. Everything that God does is obscured, because God's presence in the world obscures Bechira Chash. Surely, a read into his knowledge, if I have a terminal, which I'm able to access God's knowledge, that would obviously change everything that we would decide. As you pointed out, it would change it in a terminal manner. Good joke. You would no longer have any Bechira Chash left, because the future has been predicted for you. But the difference is between predicting and determining. God's knowledge doesn't determine the future, it predicts the future. The knowledge of God's knowledge has a determining effect. The knowledge of anyone's knowledge. If you just, let's say someone very, very smart. The wise things that I know about the future, you don't have to be smart for this. Most of us know a lot of things about the future. I know things about the future about you. Bechira Chash. I know that in the next 24 hours, you are not going to kill anybody. I don't know it perfectly, but I'm willing to bet a lot of money. 99.9%. Does that mean you don't have Bechira Chash? No, you have Bechira Chash. I know 99.9% that you're not going to do it. You still have 100% Bechira Chash. You could kill somebody if you wanted. I happen to know that you're not going to want to do it. It's not worth it to you just to disprove my share to kill somebody. If you took something a little bit less, less dramatic, you might think it's worth it. I know that you're the Ephraim Vowage, you're not going to miss me. I can see the mind, I can see the wheels turning in your head. one day, not going to show, not going to minion, that's not worth it to disprove an entire share of Rezavik. It sounds like it's a great thing to do. Okay, but I know you're not going to kill somebody. The fact that I know it has, now, if I don't tell it to you, let's say you're a particularly perverse individual. So if I don't tell you, you won't kill anybody. But suppose I just told you, I know you're not going to kill anybody. That burns in your heart. Like, he's told me that? So you're going to go and you'll kill somebody. That could be. That could play a part. I've almost forced you to do the opposite of what I told you. So I shouldn't tell you. It's very difficult to people when your parents tell you all the time they know what you're going to do. It's really very annoying, right? Because you want to have free will, and by telling you, they're ruining it for you. A good teacher, a good parent, doesn't tell his kid what he's about to do. Because either if they like the parents, they won't even try to do it, and if they hate the parents, they'll do the opposite just to spite them. You're not supposed to tell people what they're going to do. So I'm not going to tell you that you're not going to kill anybody. I don't want to get you to do it. I don't want you to prevent you from doing it. I want you to do it on your own.
On your example where you explain, but does Rav Sajigar hold that God knows the future based on the fact that he knows so much about the world?
No. It's not scientific prediction. It's the knowledge of the future. Right. In other words, but I take that as the examples that I gave. I know what you're going to do tomorrow because I know the present, and therefore I can guess with a high degree of probability what will take place in the future. Scientists know the weather tomorrow because they know the present, and therefore they can guess with 100% theoretically predictability what will take place in the future. But since if there's free will, that doesn't work. It's not because I know you in the present, I know what you're going to do in the future. No, God's knowledge of the future, I don't know how it works. I mentioned a few childish theories before about the fourth dimension, etc. But I don't know how it's going to work. It's based, no one in the Middle Ages thought of how it works. He said if God knows everything, then he knows everything. The way that God knows what's under my feet isn't because he has very good sight, better than mine. He knows it because he knows it. Because he doesn't have better information gathering techniques, which wouldn't work for the future. They wouldn't work for that part of the future, which is subject to free will. It's not better gathering. He doesn't have better sight, better hearing, better spies, better computer systems. Right? He simply knows because his knowledge is by definition infinite. Therefore, he knows everything. Okay, that can't explain how it works. I don't know how it works, but it works. But even knowledge, which is infinite and automatic, works by the cause is the knowledge. The cause is the facts, and the facts cause the knowledge, and not the other way around.
So it's not like the example with the mouse and the maze, the cheese. As in, some people say that I've heard that it's like the mouse in a maze with the cheese at the other end, and the person's watching above. Meaning, the mouse has all different avenues to go through, and the person knows every single one.
That's the fourth dimensional trick. To say it doesn't make a difference. The point is that it's not because I know the mouse that I know where he's going to go. I know where he's going to go because I know where he's going to go. In other words, the point is that although there's a vicious cycle here. If you think there's no Bechira Chofshit, doesn't exist, then everything in theory is predictable. Everything that will take place a million years from now is an automatic consequence of the way the atoms are arranged today. We work backwards, we know that everything that exists in the world today is a product of a Big Bang which took place 127 million years ago. And therefore we can predict that in another 700 billion years, the world will contract and go back to being a point of black hole. Okay? That's regular scientific theory. Everything that takes place, if you knew all the facts in the present, you would know all the facts in the future. But that's because there is no Bechira Chofshit. So if God is a very, very, very good computer, he could do that. Human beings can't do that in the near conceivable future. You can't predict the weather because in order to predict the weather, you need to know the weather facts about everything in the entire earth at the same time with the barometric pressure of it, when you can't do that. But if you did, you could tell exactly what the weather would be tomorrow. Right? That's the theory of meteorology. So God has a better computer, he could do that. But once there is Bechira Chofshit, then Bechira Chofshit means that what takes place tomorrow is not based at all on any existing facts today. It's based on a free decision tomorrow, which is not itself a effect of previous causes. If that's true, then no reading of the present could give you that information. Not even the superest computer in the world could tell you what person will freely choose tomorrow. Of course, if you're a psychologist, you think he is not freely choosing. If I knew the pressure he was under, I knew how his brain is operating, I knew how his mother treated him when he was 2 years old, I knew everything else about him, I would know what he'd do tomorrow. But that's not free choice already. If there is free choice to human beings, that means they can make uncaused choices, then nothing in the present will predict the future. But nonetheless, medieval Jewish theology, medieval Christian theology, medieval theology of all monotheistic religions says that God knows the future not by reading the present, but by reading the future. How can you read the future? I can't see the future. I don't know. God can see the future. He doesn't see the future. He just knows the future. If it's true, then he knows it. If it was false, he wouldn't know it. Anything that's true, God knows. It's true that I will raise my hand tomorrow. Well, it's not true. One of my hands I'm going to raise tomorrow. God knows which one I'm going to raise. Yeah.
How do we explain what it means when it says in Sukkim and the impressive Tanakh that Hashem regretted what he did? If he knows what's going to happen, then how can he regret anything that he does?
Okay, good kasha. Three possibilities. One is doesn't mean what you think it means. It just says it. Any other pasuk which you say is describing God in human terms, but is it godly terms is not there. So when it says that by Yinachem Alibo, God just means that God changed his course of action. Till now he played along with the world, now he's had enough is enough. Of course God knew that he would tomorrow be upset at the world, but it doesn't. Do you really imagine that it's describing God's emotional state of mind? that God was happy one day, next day he said, oh, you're about, the world is sinning, and then he became sad. Whatever, you have to say some other pshat. So that's one possibility. That's the right possibility. That's what the Rambam says in the first Chelek Moment. Right now, from the Libo, it's not describing God's feelings or change of mind. It's describing God's actions. He changed his course of action. Till now, he supported the world, and now he's going to destroy the world. The word lev is unfortunate. Because the Rambam just said by Yinachem, it would be okay. But Yinachem Adibo sounds like he's saying that he really changed his internal, the word lev is an internal word. But says, no, there's nothing internal about God. It just means, it's using human terms. If I change my actions, it means I change my mind. So it says about God, he changes. That's the Pasha Pshat. The reason why I'm answering quickly is because it is a deep question, not because necessarily of the future, it's a deep question in general. Could God change his mind? Forget about the future. If he doesn't know the future, then why do you change his mind? But, you know, change his mind means you change your attitude to something. Why would you do that? It's sort of a kind of weakness, a kind of willfulness. The Pasuk in Haftarat Dirshu says that God doesn't change his mind about anything. So the answer to may be naive is that God doesn't change his mind. But if the facts change, then God is the same thing all the time. He's doing good for the world. As you change, the good for you becomes different. So when the world changes, there's no one more Aristotelian fixed God than the Ralbag. Ralbag says God is doing good for the world. When the world looks like it looked in the age of Noah, then good for the world is to be destroyed. But God is the same thing. He's simply showering good on the world. Of course, when you shower good in the world, you have to take into account what you're doing. You know, what's good for you is not good for him. Otherwise, I'd be just an idiot. So God, as a wise person, the good for the world is good for Noah to be in the Teva, good for the world for Noah to be in the Teva, and good for the world for everybody else to be dead. Which was the same good he did when he gave trees to Adam HaRishon. It's the same thing exactly. That's what it means by Yinachem Alibo, says the Rabban. It means he changed his course of action in accord with the non-changing, totally constant attitude he had towards the world. Yeah.
So from what you're saying, do you think it's wrong to say that God is outside time?
Personally, yes, but it's irrelevant to what I'm talking about. In other words, if God is outside time, it happens to make it easier on this thing, because you want to know, like, what does it mean God knows the future? But it doesn't make a difference. If God is inside time, he just happens to know the future because he knows everything. It doesn't bother me. Say, look, I don't understand what the words mean that God is outside of time. But that goes back to a question which I'm not going to discuss, namely, what is time? That is not appropriate for this particular chut, nor do I know the answer, which is why it's not appropriate for this particular chut. Anything I know, I'm going to share with you, but what is time? Wow, there's one of the volumes of in philosophy. When I studied philosophy, I believe there were three theories of time. There's an appendix to, I don't know which volume, of the Torah Shlema, and the Torah Shlema is a collection of Midrashim, but in the back, every volume has appendixes, because Rav Kasha, while he was writing it, just accumulated information, and so he wrote these long appendixes. So he has an appendix there called What is Time? I believe that in Mekorot Yehudiyim, he found 14 shitot. It's a bit exaggerated, but so if you want, you can find them. Where would it be? I don't know. There are 30 volumes of the Torah Shlema. Just go through all 30 till you find it. He has 14 shitot, but Sadik on the Rambam, Yanko Shmerel, 14 shitot in the nature of time. I don't plan to discuss that. But Chasdei Kreska, supposed to Rambam, thinks that time is not the reason why. It is interesting. In other words, at some point, you probably heard that God is above time. The reason, historically speaking, why philosophers claim that God is above time is because they define time as being the change in motion of physical objects. And therefore, someone who is not physical does not exist in time. The fact that everybody in third grade thinks that God is above time is not because of that reason, because they don't understand the reason I just said, nor do they even believe it. Is that the definition of time? Time is the ticking of the hand. Not the ticking of the hand measures time. Time is the ticking of the hand. If nothing moves, if we just freeze, Aristotle said time does not pass. It does, because theoretically something else is moving. But if nothing could be able to move, there would be no time. That's not Einstein's theory of time. And Rafasi says, no, time is duration. Things exist in time. Something which is not moving also exists in time. And something which is spiritual, not physical, also exists in time. Which is what we actually think about time. Aristotle messed up someone's mind, and then he messed up our minds. But no one in this room thinks that time is an effect of motion. It doesn't make any sense. When you're sleeping, so time doesn't pass. Of course it passes. Nothing moves, but time passes. But there's a whole Greek theory here, which somehow is taught to little Jewish children. I don't know why.
So no, I don't think that God. I don't think that God is a bafana. Maybe it could be bafana. I don't know. Nothing for, nothing against. There's no particular reason to think so. But it doesn't make a difference. When I say that God knows everything, it's because He knows everything, not because He has better telescopes. His telescope is a fourth dimensional telescope. It's true. If you had a fourth dimensional telescope, you would know what's take place tomorrow. Maybe. But God doesn't use fourth dimensional telescopes. He doesn't use fifth dimensional telescopes. He doesn't use telescopes. Nor does He use glasses. Nor does He squint. He doesn't have eyes. He just knows. He's pure knowledge. If you have pure knowledge, you know everything. Even those things which you have no way of gathering the information in a physical manner. You don't have to see things physically to know that they're true. If I have ESP, then I know things without seeing them. God has very good ESP. He knows the future. I mean, I understand. I, why you don't understand the question? Because primitive people had no problems with this. They primitive people, I mean some of your neighbors. They think that they're clairvoyants. People who are just, they see the future. That's okay. But that God can see the future, that becomes problematic. Why can't God see the future if my neighbor can see the future? Madam Van Buren. You know, I mean, she's been dealing in the stock market for years, making a fortune. If she can do it, then come on. Surely God can do it. Just you and I, you can't do it because we're stuck with this overly scientific education that we got. But just free yourself of it. You know, I mean, the Russians spent millions of dollars investigating clairvoyance in an attempt to get out of the United States. Russian scientists, I mean, not Russian mystics, not the monks, but, you know, the guys who got good education. And frankly, Duke University built its whole reputation. Anyone, they must have a football team. Duke University is famous for only one thing, other than their football team. Duke University had a serious laboratory, maybe they still have it, to investigate extrasensory perception. And 50 years ago, they were able to show that there was a 2% difference between the guys who were good at it and the guys who were bad at it in guessing cards. And I'm not sure they've shown anything since, but this laboratory just kept on going for year after year after year, and that's why Duke is famous. Do they have a football team? They must. Basketball team. Okay. So their basketball team is probably as good as their ESP laboratory. But the Russians took it apparently really seriously. They were working on kinetics. They were planning to move missiles by the power of mind. Very useful thing. And, you know, we could use it too. It would save us a lot of problems in Gaza. But at the same time, it doesn't work so well. But God can do it. Yeah. God moves things. How does God move things? He moves them. How does God know things? He knows them. I don't have to define how it works. Okay, I said, that's why I think this problem is not really interesting, but it's so famous that you have to talk about it. The next problem, the might of God, the power of God, or the power of physics, either one or the other, so what does it actually mean? Can there be freedom in a world in which there's causation? And religious people believe in causation. They think that God is the cause of everything. That still doesn't mean, that still leaves out, what does it mean that there's an uncaused action? What is an uncaused action? My will caused it. What causes my will? So we automatically tend to think there must be a cause. So that we'll discuss B'ezrat Hashem next time, and I'll try to explain why it's not just sustainable, but in fact necessary, and why it is in fact not just an erech of Yiddishkeit, but erech of anyone who has erech. If you have any values at all that aren't physical and materialistic atoms connecting, then you must believe in freedom, and then we'll try to explain how it works. Okay?
Jerry, just my, I got this.